Okay, right. I'm going to ask all of the presenters that presented during the day that are still here to come up onto the podium. We've got three chairs up here, but you might need to bring a few chairs with you, and I'm going to open the floor to questions. While you guys are assembling, I just thought I'd thank everybody for their presentations today and for you listening to them all. I think you'll agree we've had a real jam-packed programme, and I actually think it's really benefited from having the cross-industry focus. I think it's been quite clear that we've all got very similar issues, common issues, and we're all tackling it from a similar way, but we can obviously all learn from one another. And what's been really great is we've moved not only from theory, but all the way through to practical application of some of the issues that have been raised. So while we have all these experts here, I urge you to take the opportunity to pick their brains further. So I open it to the floor.
I'm Simon Butler. I'm the national organiser for ASLEF, which is the Trade Drivers Union. I'm not a senior official for the union. I've been a train driver for 22 years and I still got a licence. Now, one of the problems that we face within the rail industry is it's all well and good having the processes and the procedures, and we as a trade union have been really driving this, and actually driving it in many ways ahead of the management team, because we wanted to break the link, we wanted to make a distinction between conduct, you know, fighting, late on duty, that kind of thing, and competency. And we share many things with the military, and one of the things we do share is the birth of the railways, and we still have a discipline culture that is based on military court martials. We still get a form one charge, and we have a hearing officer. It's breaking the managerial mentality. And if we are going to see a just system, it needs to be delivered at the point of contact with the staff. Because if they don't see it as just, then it's not going to happen. It's all right, the director's buying into it and saying, yeah, this is great. And the senior officials will say, yeah, it's great. And it's a big problem for us to convince our people on the floor that this is a good thing if it's going to get messed up by the local managers. And the question is how do you see it being delivered effectively, particularly when you've got very adversarial type history, at a local level?
Well, I agree entirely what you're saying. And I would say back to my presentation, or just a nice presentation, the thing that doesn't change is the workforce. The senior management changes on a regular basis, and I can only speak for ScotRail. We have a fantastic relationship with our company council. Every time we try to do something in the simulator, we consult with them, and we listen to what they say, and you know, we're here to provide a service for our drivers. So it's a team effort. It's us and the unions together. We're the people that can make it work. The management, we have to then build up business cases and point out where the benefits are going to be, so that we can then say to them, look, together, the simulator professionals, the training and development professionals, and the union think this is a really good idea, and this is how it's going to change your business. If we do that together, then we will be able to make changes.
Can I add something to that? We've been playing around with this in aviation maintenance now for about 15 or 20 years, and frankly, it's not the bottom or the top that don't want this. When we talk about just culture, about the doing of this stuff, it gets difficult in the middle for the supervisors and managers. And it's just about winning their hearts and minds. Everyone looks at everything in this respect with regard to what's in it for them. How's it going to change our world? And as long as the organisation understands why it wants to do this, what the benefits are, then it doesn't tend to have a problem to convince itself to embark upon it. It only gets difficult when the middle managers don't know how to apply the just culture. They've never been trained in it. They don't even know it exists, typically, until they're confronted with a guy or girl in front of them who didn't do what we asked them to do. So it's just a process like anything else, and it just needs to be dealt with as such. But believe me, we work with some very, very difficult organisations in terms of worker management relationships. They're the ones who go for it in the greatest way, in our experience. They really just go, wow, I wish we had this 20 years ago. And you get managers who reflect on their own behaviour and say, wow, I really got this wrong. And workers and unions.
Spot
on. Yeah, and you've got to give them a tool set. You've got to train them. They've got to know why they're doing it. They've got to know what's in it for them and you and the organisation. Teach them how to do it. Refresh it occasionally. It's not a big training program we're talking about here. People get it. As long as you make it relatively straightforward, they get it.
The problem is, once you've lost it, another mountain climb to get it back.
Yeah.
Oh, you've seen it from an international airline this morning in my presentation, who have a safety management system that we all looked in at and envied. And the way they're behaving publicly is suggesting that they don't indeed have a safety management system or a just culture. And they've got a big problem now to win that back. In fact, it takes you back further than where you started.
Mm.
It's the behaving, it's how you do it that dictates whether you do or not succeed in this stuff. But actually, it isn't that difficult, believe me. It is not that difficult. If the British military can do it successfully, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, the British military, <I don't know. laughs> if they can do it successfully, and they are, then anybody can. Now I've blown it, haven't I? It's going so well till then.
Have I any other comments from the panel?
Just one, having been middle manager in the military, I know exactly what he's talking about, and you know that. It's exactly the same in the rail industry. The fear factor of change is greatest with the middle management. Those are the people who are absolutely petrified of change because they are the traditionalists. They've come up as drivers. Now they're in a position where they can make things happen. They're a little bit unsure about whether that's a good idea, a bad idea, or let's just stay the way we are, shall we, because that's the easy way.
So, well, the transition that we made, we went from Connex South Central to South, those who live in the South East and experience the Connex experience. The industrial relations from Connex to Southern was done in a couple of months, but it was there was a real do-or-die for the company. But we're having problems with where our industrial relations are poor. It's National Express, it's certain sections of the First Group, and it's middle managers. And we're the ones that wanted to progress our people, protect our people, train our people, and we've been push back all the time. It's a real problem because we're the ones that
are cold-fashioned. Very briefly, a lot of organisations that I've been to think they have a terrible blame culture because everybody tells us they do. Until you ask them to prove to you when they last did this blame thing, and they typically haven't. People dip back 20 years about old Bob who got punished 20 years ago, and he was punished appropriately, as it turns out, when you apply the new models. It's just knowing where you are and where you want to go to, and then it's just a step management process.
Okay, I'll bring that discussion to an end. Next.
Okay. I'd like to address my question to Steve Bredmore in terms of the threat narrow management thinking, and in particular the line operational safety audit. You mentioned that, in fact, there are probably only about 35 airlines that have undergone this. Some of them have gone two or three times, but you know, there are 1,000 airlines in the world. And do you feel that there's something wrong with the sort of propagation of this? Because this is such a valuable tool, not only for aviation, but more widely in the industry. And what can we do about it?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question, David. It is a concern, I think. When we decided we wanted to do one, and by the way, I went to school with James Klinek, so I know him very well, so I felt like I sort of had the inside track. It still took us, you know, I think a good 18 months to get into the pipeline for it, which is, as you said, there's a lot of ground to cover, and you can't do it at that pace. So I've asked James that, you know, what's the long-term plan, and I think he's working on that. But, you know, in the meantime, I think one of the things I've been surprised is that there hasn't been sort of the propagation of similar kinds of tools other places, and I think in part because the value of the LOSA methodology is so strong, and the fact that you can compare to an archive of data that's already there, it's sort of that, you know, that's the one you want to go with. But I mean, the methodology could be applied by others, I think, and similar tools developed in other ways. But they clearly have to increase the throughput. It's tremendously valuable, and we have to figure out a way to get it to spread it faster.
I mean, maybe the Royal Aeronautical Society could get in behind this, and perhaps IATA, but ICAO is so supportive of it.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to propagate, and yet it's such a valuable tool.
Yeah, I'm with you. As I said, as a safety officer, it's probably the single best report I've ever seen on what your operation looks like at any given time. So.
Okay. Okay, question at the back.
I'm just touching on LiveSet. I just want to say that I'm quite familiar with the UK that have developed their own in-house LiveSet programs. So all the material that you need to run a LiveSet is freely available on the web. It's published by IKEA and also by the UKA. So all of the documentation is there. Mm-hmm. And that was released by
And as you said, James is very supportive of that in terms of providing the tools for airlines to do that. But to lose the benchmarking is significant. Also, there's a tremendous amount of investment in the calibration of the observers as well. And if you don't, if you aren't tapped into that expertise and that resource in terms of the LISA collaborative, I think there's potential there to run into some problems. But the tools are out there.
Yeah. Okay, next question from the floor. Any more? Stunned silence. Yep.
A question about the relationship between quality and safety. So I think we've heard two different ideas about that. And this morning was a question which appeared to indicate that they should be separate issues. And I think Steve Breton was saying that in your arena you have actually brought them together. And I note in the health service is now very concerned about quality issues and also about safety issues. So anybody out there who like to illuminate us about how they see
it. I actually agreed with the remarks this morning in terms of, I'm trying to recreate, you'll have to forgive me, the jet lag's catching up with me now. I think the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, with any dimension of quality, and I consider safety a dimension of quality in terms of you're trying to drive some performance improvement through a process, and to the extent that the outcomes are determined by humans and humans make errors, again, you see sort of similar outcomes across different dimensions of quality. So I think there is a positive correlation between operational performance and safety. And that was really the point around safety. In terms of the SMS methodology, the application of system quality management principles, I share the concerns about it becoming overly process-driven, overly bureaucratic, and really about building a document, not about, at the end of the day, improving your operation. I think that danger is there.
Okay. I would agree with all of that. We use the European Foundation for Quality Management model as a way to in which to do our annual annual business planning. And from that, we derive a number of improvement areas, which are then prioritised for the improvement plan for the following year. We've now been using that for about 5 years, and it integrates both safety and quality measures that we'll carry forward and move, and actually do something quite seriously with the next year. Attach budgets to, investments to those priority areas. And it's been a really good way for us to focus on, as a whole management team, what are the things we need to change next year. And every year we've seen incremental improvements.
What's amazing to me is how many quality management, system safety management experts there are out there now. There's not a day that goes by I don't get 4 emails. No offense, Kevin. I haven't gotten any from you. But how many rocks have turned over and folks have come out now as system safety experts? It's remarkable.
Okay, I think we have a question down the front here.
So the answer, just quickly going back to the problem with the IOSA problem, it's the extent of it. That's the problem. I've spoken to several airlines who've done it, who wish to do it, and it's very, very expensive in time, resource, and cash. But
are you talking about LOSA?
Sorry?
Was that in regards to LOSA?
LOSA, yes.
Yeah, I actually found it to be fairly cheap. It was much less expensive than I would have expected, again, given sort of the...
It depends where you're coming from.
Right.
In the size of your organisation. I didn't want to get into that really. I wanted to come back to it. What was a statement, what was a question? What I was very interested struck on the rail versus the aviation side about the selection process, because that's what's changed in the aviation business, which at the moment is still open to the rail. You can do a selection for your drivers, I'm assuming, by a testing and a competence issue.
Yeah.
And that's how you select them.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, what I can say is, I mean, I look after recruitment in our business. In answer to your question about do we get different people, yes, because we're probably attracting more qualified people than we used to do. I think, I mean, someone alluded to the family tradition recruitment patterns that used to apply in, I think it was with you, with lifeboats, that also used to apply in rail. For all sorts of reasons, we're much more stringent about not having nepotism, but having equality in application processes against the job criteria. But certainly, the whole gaming culture does mean that people's hand-eye coordination tends to be a lot more sophisticated than it used to be. In terms of training, I think people eat up the training much more readily and easily, and they're amazed at how low tech we probably have been. So simulators, to them, they love them because they can do all sorts of things in them that appeal to the gaming culture, if you like. Mm-hmm. But Roger's the expert on driver training, and we're working with Roger on, so what does that tell us about how we should be doing things in mm-hmm. the future, including much more so self-directed learning, much more group work, much more experiential learning than the kind of chalk and talk that traditionally we've been doing a lot of.
The other thing I'd say is we are, as an industry, going through the process of looking at our selection criteria and actually looking at how we can change our selection processes to take that into account. I think one of the critical things is then how we take what we learn when we're from people that have gone through the process, what we see on their psychometric test, and actually pull that into the training process. So if you see that someone is perhaps particularly strong in one area, but perhaps less strong in another, how do you make sure that knowledge gets pulled through into the training process? Sorry.
I'll comment on it a little, if you like. I mean, it's quite interesting for us because our people select us as well. We don't advertise and wait for a list of candidates. They walk in the station and express an interest. And certainly in the demographic question, in terms of the gaming nation, gaming generation, our training has changed probably 180 degrees in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, we were trying to make fishermen, seamen, practical people understand how to use electronic chart navigation equipment. Now, that's dead easy. The challenge is teaching people who've never done anything like how to tie a knot, how to get on the foredeck, how to conduct themselves, how to hold on, how to, like, maybe look out the window occasionally. You've got 14 windows and two screens. So maybe that's the ratio we should use them. That's been our challenge as an organisation. but certainly it's changed our training pattern and how we're having to train people. Electronics is now dead easy. But actually going out on the after deck to secure a tow, which used to be dead easy, is bloody dangerous in some instances now, you know.
But is that because the individuals you're attracting in are different to the ones you used to attract?
Yeah.
Yes, from our perspective, yes. The generational, family traditional thing is going. People are far more transient. They don't know what a lifeboat is when they move to the village, but they think it'd be a funky thing to be involved in. They've got the time and the availability, and they're prepared to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. So it's our duty of care to train them. But yeah, it's very different to any of the industries that are here. But you know, it is an experience that's coming to us, in that we've, you know, hence the reason in the last 5 years we've invested, you know, £4 million a year in training, whereas when I joined the RNLI, the training budget was 200 grand, and that's only a decade ago. But it gives you some indication of the problems we have.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would have noticed in the threat and air management model that we use, one of the barriers that we spend a fair amount of time working through is automation management, and what level of automation is appropriate for what sort of situations, and those are the scenarios that they run, you know, in the simulator. Sometimes the appropriate thing, shut it all off. I mean, if the automation's the issue, shut it off and hand fly it, and ensuring the pilots are capable of doing that proficiently is a key part of the training. But, and then, as you mentioned, the transition to performance-based training versus hours-based, is going to be really critical, because then you can build your training program around the data that say we're really good at this, or we spend very little time doing that, or whatever it might be, and build your training program around what are your strong and where you're weak.
We worried about this in civil aviation, particularly in maintenance. We worried about new generation, new technology aeroplanes causing people to forget basic skills. No different. How do you rig an aeroplane? Well, you press a button and you wait until you get a green light or not. The reality is that the studies the CAA have done over the last few years in maintenance error have proven that's not the case. We haven't got that problem. We've got the problem we knew we'd always have. Putting aeroplanes back together is more risky than taking them apart. Dear old Jim Reason did that with his nut and bolt theory 20 years ago. And we know it now. And what we actually know now, and what error management systems have given us the ability to do, is to know what to worry about in there. And I'm not sure you've got that in the flight ops world yet. I can tell you that if you touch a door, chapter 52 on an aeroplane, it's going to go wrong. So don't touch it. So it's probably good that you're not touching the aeroplane too much, because all the areas... Yeah. All the areas where it peaks are where we touch it a lot. The engines, the undercarriage, wheels, tyres and brakes, doors, chapter 25, passenger, the thing the passenger touches. All the soft squidgy bits that we touch every time the aircraft lands. That's where our problems are. So at least we now know what to worry about. And if we get that stuff proactively, because we've got fair cultures, we're going to get it before it's caused us losses. Therefore, we can learn proactively, and we're becoming predictive. Trick is joining it up. And it's us maintenance guys talking to you flight ops guys, and then all of us talking to the rest of the threat generators out there who touch our aeroplanes. And that's safety management.
It's a good theory. Okay. Error management has been stubbornly 6% in the airline industry for the last 8 years. It's not going down.
Okay. Any more questions from the floor?
They got my back here. This is great. Great question. I short answer, if you can't find it in-house, you go out and get it. But, I think in aviation, particularly on the flight side, we've been doing this now long enough, it's not difficult to find folks who understand it, I mean, really get it and can teach it. It's sort of like now, every pilot used to be a lawyer and every pilot used to be a real estate agent, and they still are, but now they're also a human factors expert. So, but it's the key is to find the ones that can really translate it and teach it well. I guess my sense is it hasn't been an issue for some time now, just because we've been doing this long enough. But as you get into other domains, maintenance and the ramp and so forth, that is the challenge. It's finding folks that can bridge and translate between the guy on the line, the gal on the line, and the concepts, the management concepts. Like I said, you just keep looking until you find the folks who can do that.
Can I also add to that? Yeah. In the clinical world, everything has to be evidence-based, ticked off. You like every professional body. So really, what people look for in healthcare or starting to look for is they're aware of the ergonomic society or something that will back up the fact that you have expertise. Obviously, there's a lot of people around who are coming from other areas who are still doing human factors. And, being honest, the more the merrier right now before we get to a stage of actually saying, actually, this is what it is and not this. So, we're at the beginning, but that's the way clinical people like to look for. So,
the thing I'd say about, certainly in rail, I mean, clearly we have two fairly substantial sized human factors team, one within RSSB, but also one within Network Rail, being the major infrastructure owner. We've tried very hard, certainly as RSSB, to support our companies through our research program, trying to identify and provide practical solutions to the issues that they raise, but also not being frightened to give some of it back. I mean, we've tried to develop, certainly through our standards regime, guidance on things like cognitive and individual risk factors, so they understand the information processing model and why things go wrong in terms of train drivers, what they can do about it themselves, and trying to give information in a tangible, usable form. And I don't think we should be frightened to say that you have to have human factors specialists. I think it's for us as human factors specialists to try and make our discipline available and usable, and I don't think we should be snobby about that. I think there's lots of people out there that can pick that information up and could do a really fantastic job, and I think that's beginning to filter through into the rail industry. There's some fantastic work out there that's going on, not by human factors specialists, but by the operators that have become aware of why it's important.
On the regulatory perspective, we had a sort of double-edged sword problem, really, that before the implementation of the requirement to have CRM instructors wholesale through the industry, we had a number of very, very good CRM experts. And by opening up Pandora's box, the concern was we were going to dilute the standard of CRM training through the industry. In some areas, that might be true. So what we're trying to do now is to raise the bar, and it's for us on the CRM advisory panel and the examiners out there to raise the standards and start, as you say, sharing the discipline around and improving the standard.
But just even in terms of making sure that people are aware of good practice that their colleagues are doing, trying to help the industry understand, get data about what the major human factors issues, the key errors that are going on, and actually taking a lot of their learning from the research and putting it in practical tools that people can use, a bit like we were talking about with Kevin's sort of tool. I mean, it's translating what could be perhaps a little bit intimidating and complicated into sort of simple things that people can actually use. And I think whoever was saying, I think it was Steve actually, we failed if we don't do that. If it's not actually practically being used, then we may well have not bothered doing the work in the first place. So anyway, it's my soapbox.
From a practical point of view, I think you've just got to look at the audience who are going to receive that training. So for the RNLI, it was quite appropriate because they assessed that it should be somebody from outside, where there are other people who would rather have the information coming from somebody who understood their own disciplines. So you have to decide which is going to be most appropriate for your organisation, rather than saying this is the way you should do it.
Okay, yes.
In the aviation industry, it's believed that about 75-85% of all incidents, accidents are caused by error, human factor error. Yet we've been doing CRM training for 20-odd years, and it hasn't reduced on that figure. How would you account for this?
Redesign the human? That might help.
But despite all the efforts of CRM input into it, which I believe you're referring to, the figure remains consistent. It hasn't changed.
I'd like to answer that actually, because and I'm touching wood and hugging wood actually, but since Kegworth, in the UK, and we do a lot of flying in the UK, I don't think we've had a serious human factors incident since then, and that's an amazing record, and we do a lot of flying here, so I think it has made a difference. I think it may not have a difference globally, and that's because I think the standard of CRM training globally is iffy, but I think in the UK, I think standard CRM training is good, and I think because of that, it has definitely made an effect statistically on the incident and accident rate in the UK.
Well, in the world, I mean, it's 1 per 2 million sectors where accident rate is reduced dramatically in the last decade. Much of that's got to do with the approaches and human factors.
I can't comment about CRM, I'm afraid, but I can about maintenance error. And we've seen a dramatic drop-off in the last 6 years in terms of maintenance error on aircraft over 5,700 kilograms on the G register. We've seen it.
If you talk about evidence in this area, many years ago, there were, I think, somewhere between 18 and 20 hull losses per year of aircraft of a substantial size. I've forgotten the exact weight, the large jet aircraft. I think that has become it has remained a similar figure throughout the years, whereas the amount of aviation that goes on has exponentially increased. So in fact, the safety record is in fact much, much better. Now whether you put that down to a human factors issue or not is the question which none of us can actually answer. We have a belief though, belief, and you're allowed to have beliefs in this world.
I would never speak for Professor Reason, but I just, sort of drawing on what he was talking about this morning, if you look at sort of taking all in the causes of these kinds of accidents, and could be aircraft issues, could be environmental issues, airspace, those are sort of the latent conditions that exist from operator to operator and flight to flight, through the system. What varies on any given day is the performance of the human. the individual. And so I think from that standpoint, they're always at the pointy end. That's where you're going to see the largest variability and probably the biggest contributor. Also, it's a zero-sum game. I mean, something's got to be the number one cause. I'm not sure we'd feel any better if, you know, the 70% were due to airplanes falling apart or whatever. So just a thought.
I don't think there is.
There's not. And let's face it, we've been messing around. We've been studying, playing with, trying to convince ourselves of the need to apply human factors in our world for 30 years or more in aviation. And it's only regulation that's actually caused it to happen, in my opinion. I don't know many organisations, probably one or two, who convinced themselves of the value to do it because it was good for the bottom line.
Three.
They're out there, but there are less of them.
That, I think, is probably our biggest threat out there.
Absolutely.
If it's just going, we've got the bottom line going, there's a force in that venturi that just needs something.
Yeah, well, there's nothing formal there, and when we do talk to them, we talk to them in our language, not theirs. We don't talk profit and loss, we talk safety. And they haven't got a safety problem.
No.
Okay, I'm going to allow one more question from the floor and then I'm going to call the proceedings to an end. So any more questions? Okay, I have a couple of announcements. Firstly, in relation to today's meeting, all of the presentations will be on the website, and if you keep your programme page, you'll see right at the bottom it gives you the link. Not only will it have all of the presentations and speakers' biographies, but it will also have links to the JARTEL NOTAX that were mentioned by, I think, Captain Newson, the videos. And also, I think Rick said that there would be Transport Canada's single pilot videos on there as a useful resource for you, as well as all of the audio tracks. All of today's proceedings have been recorded, so they'll be available to listen to again, should you wish to. So that's that notice in relation to this meeting. Just another thing to bring to your attention, there is a flight test group lecture this evening. I believe in here it begins at 6, but there'll be refreshments beforehand on the F-35 Lightning II flight test update. If any of you wish to attend that, it is free to attend, so feel free to hang around. And I'm going to hand over to Carey, who's going to do a sales pitch for another meeting as well.
Thank you very much, Anne. Thank you also for chairing the day so successfully. It sounds like it's been an excellent day. Thank you all very much for coming and make it a success. I hope you learnt a lot and found it enjoyable. The plug I'm going to make is we have a lecture here on the 9th of July. It's titled Human Factors in Design. So if I'm not don't know if anybody's particularly interested in that, but if you know people who are, there are some pamphlets at the end of that table. And we're looking at really the start of the process and making sure that human factors in design is addressed so that by the time it gets to the aircraft, it's all tickety-boo. So if anybody has an interest in that, it's on the 9th of July. Thank you very much and safe journey. Ciao.
I would just urge you, if you have a moment, to fill out your feedback form and just leave it on the end of the table. That would be very useful for us to know how well it went and how we could do better in the future. Many thanks.